Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bartlett Naylor, the Financial Policy Advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the Principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as the Chief of Investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bartlett Naylor.
It's a privilege to speak with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Bart. And the Wells Fargo did an internal report which came out yesterday where they pinned most of the blame for the bank's fraud scandal on two former executives, John Stumpf, the former chief executive, and Carrie Tolstead, the former head of community banking. And they're clawing back $75 million in severance pay to these executives, which amounts to the largest forced return of pay and stock grants in banking history. So would you concur with that, that this is a pretty big deal?
Well, it is notable. If you pause for a minute and say, if you read the actual company's press statement, they say that it's interesting language. They taken executive compensation actions totaling over $180 million. In other words, they don't actually use the word there, clawback. And you have to begin and say, $180 million, you mean there was more money left. That is to say, Tolstead and Stumpf still have many dozens of millions of dollars that they were compensated for over the years. It is notable, it is laudable that the bank took at least some action. But, of course, I believe much more needs to be done.
So how much has the bank suffered? Do we know? Because it was such an outrageous thing to do, to set up accounts for customers without telling them and charging them extra fees. And from what I recall when the story broke, that in effect what they did was they fired all the good people who were uncomfortable with it and who didn't want to meet these unreasonable targets, which they had to be met at the expense of their own customers. And they tried to sort of do a cosmetic house cleaning, effectively getting rid of the whistleblowers. But I don't think they got away with it. And my understanding is that the bank has suffered.
I think it has suffered in terms of reputation and so forth. Among the victims, of course, are the shareholders who thought that those cross-sell, namely the account creation figures, were genuine and they were remarkable. Public Citizen itself documented that they were always up from 1998. They never had a decline. They were always up. You have to wonder if the antenna, such as with Bernie Madoff, should have been up with such consistently aggressive sales numbers. So shareholders suffered when we found out that was built on bogus numbers. Among the things that came out in this report that you just mentioned are the honest employees, if you will. They documented that between 30 and 41% turnover in the workforce per year. Now imagine that. They have a workforce in the community bank of something like 110,000 people. That means 30,000 people left the company, either because they failed to make quota, that they were felt too much pressure to make quota, or somehow things didn't work out. The number of people that were terminated for fabricating accounts is thought to be 5,000. I'm a little skeptical of that number. I don't know how you figure out in a mass of 30,000 employees per year which ones might have fabricated accounts and left the company. But clearly, Wells Fargo, a consumer name, has suffered. It's reflected in the share price. It's reflected in the fact that Wells Fargo is no longer known for the stagecoach, but is known for fake accounts.
So let's zero in on the people that were fired, that extraordinary turnover. We don't, within that figure, you don't know how many people of conscience were fired who simply, you know, not that they couldn't make these unreasonable goals, which meant they had to con customers, but also, is there any understanding of how many people were either whistleblowers or had a moral conscience?
The 110-page report authored largely by a law firm called Sherman & Sterling doesn't go into those kind of details. It's a 110-page report, which is is better than nothing. I would not call it by any means a white flash. It's been called scathing. I would call it something short of that. It doesn't document those numbers. It said it did 100 interviews. And certainly that's, you know, notable, but I think there are some reporters that do two-part series that interview 100 people. They investigated 1,000 reports, namely these would presumably be reports from people such as employees who are complaining. But again, we're talking about 30,000 people per year that are leaving the company. So I think the report fell quite short of producing the kind of documentation that would answer questions such as yours, namely how many people failed to make quota because they were doing their job correctly and therefore were terminated.
And again, I'm speaking with Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., where he works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as the chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. So my understanding, though, is that there have been amongst the what the report was outlining was that ex-workers were filing suit. And these are the people who had been left holding the bag, said a lawyer for the workers. So where does that stand? In other words, are they out of the woods? I mean, it's one thing to claw back money from rewarding these two top bankers with golden parachutes who had overseen, either in terms of John Stumpf, apparently turned a blind eye. It's hard to know that he didn't know. And Carrie Tolstead, she apparently was the one who was cracking the whip and, as head of community banks, forcing the employees to attain these unreasonable and dishonest goals.
Wells Fargo faces a number of contests ahead. The shareholder meeting is coming up, I believe it's April 25th. The leading proxy advisory services have called for shareholders to vote against the board of directors. One of them says those that served during the time of the problem, and the other calls for the ouster of all the board. Public Citizen has a shareholder resolution calling for a study of the breakup based on the fact that we think the company is too big to manage. Most importantly, there is, we believe, a federal investigation that could lead to a prosecution. And there are at least two things that I think are outstanding in that case. One is fraud by Wells Fargo with respect to these clients. Related to that is what's known as internal controls. The bank has to attest that it is in control of how it's operating. This report itself by Sherman and Sterling attests to the fact that it was not. And then finally, there's the issue of perjury by John Stumpf for two hearings in Congress, Senate and House. Among the things that should be questioned is when he learned about the massive terminations. I believe he said that it was fairly recently. This report itself shows that he was made aware of this as early as 2004, I think, by Tolstead, when she pointed out that some of the sales goals and the incentive compensation structures are leading to inappropriate sales.
Well, but didn't they also, though, smother these lawsuits from customers by moving them into private arbitration?
Yes. Mandatory arbitration, as your listeners will well understand, are these small print clauses in your contract that says that if you have a complaint and you believe that there is a violation of law, you can't go to court. You must submit to a closed-door arbitration. If your claim is small, such as you believe there was a $10 fee that was inappropriate, there is no reason for you to spend the $500 on arbitration. The Wells Fargo did settle a class action lawsuit rather than forcing into arbitration for $110 million, which we certainly welcome. But that the Wells Fargo illustrates clearly the problem with other banks and other commercial firms, that these mandatory arbitration clauses are an invitation for companies to put in little rip-off fees. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has a forthcoming rule that would ban them in financial contracts. Of course, Public Citizen believes they should be banned in or they should be at the discretion of the consumer in all consumer contracts.
But the work that you and others have done at Public Citizen, Bart Naylor, I believe indicates that Wells Fargo's cross-selling mania didn't begin in 2004, as this report that Wells Fargo just commissioned indicates, that it could have gone back as early as 1998.
Yes. We documented that the sales figures were rising suspiciously strongly, dating as far back as 1998. And we think it's a problem at Wells Fargo. We think it may well be a problem with all of the major banks, that they are under tremendous pressure to demonstrate their value to shareholders and put their employees under these horrendous sales quota goals. The problem is clear at Wells Fargo, but if you look at the complaint database, for example, at the CFPB, this same issue rises even more robustly with, or more gravely with, Bank of America.
Well, but the people who work in banks consider themselves members of the middle class, but their pay, they get paid much less than the average workers, do they not? They're kind of not too different from fast food workers in terms of their compensation.
Roughly 30% of bank tellers are on some form of government assistance. They are so poorly paid.
30%?
Roughly.
Wow. So next time you go up to your smiling teller who says, "How are you having a nice day? How's your day going today?" and all that kind of stuff, which they're trained to say, that's worth keeping in mind, that one in three of them are on some kind of government assistance. Yeah, because the bank won't pay them a living wage, right?
J.P. Morgan, for example, a similar size to Wells Fargo, more than 200 and some thousand employees. And yes, 2,000 people get more than $1 million a year at J.P. Morgan. But again, about a third of the tellers, which is the line, and the line workers, which is the lion's share, are, you know, just a little bit above minimum wage. $15 an hour is the starting wage at Wells Fargo, and that's an increase.
So where does this come from then? I mean, what happened with Stump reminds me of what happened at Volkswagen, where the guy in charge was this, you know, arrogant SOB who, you know, supposedly turned a blind eye to how they were rigging the emissions tests on the diesel engine, and they'd set it that it only came into play when it was being tested, but for the rest of the time it was spewing out nitrous oxide. Now, it's a similar situation, isn't it, where he had to step down. He got a massive multi-billion dollar, I think, payout, but he claims that he didn't know what these engineers were up to. Do you see a similarity there?
It is possible, and some of the accounts of the report pin the problem on Carrie Tolstaff, the head of the Community Bank Division, that she was stifling relaying some of the reports. But if you carefully read the Sherman and Sterling report, there were a number of alarm bells from a number of departments, risk, audit, legal department, about some of these terminations for fake accounts and other risk controls. Some of it is true, some of it didn't reach the board, but some of it did, or at least was available to the board. So, for example, the Los Angeles Times reported this in 2013, and it's still about a half year later before the board begins to take this more seriously. So, again, we think the bank is too big to manage, that there are probably a sizable number of risk items that the board and senior management apparently fails to dig into. That's another one of, I think, the key findings. It's not highlighted in the Sherman and Sterling report. The key findings is that the cross-sell forgery was one of many risk items that went to the board, and yet we shareholders and the public haven't really heard what those others are. So apparently serious problems are not uncommon at Wells Fargo, and yet it doesn't come to light.
Right, but how blind was the board of Wells Fargo not to notice that the CEO, John Stumpf, who's just had some money clawed back, although it looks like he's still keeping an awful lot, he bragged in 2014 that Wells Fargo customers had an average of 6.17 accounts per household. Now, who needs to have six bank accounts?
Right.
I mean,
what you say blind. I would say asleep. I mean, there is a motivation not to to raise questions on a board. They're being paid, $250,000 a year. And if they were beginning to ask a lot of questions at board meetings, that sort of ruins the mood and delays the time before they get to go to dinner.
And I take it that's pretty common across the board in corporate America.
I unfortunately think it is. I think boards of directors are in fact window dressing when they really need to be asking very difficult questions and granular questions, as should have been the case in this cross-selling forgery.
Mm. Well, I was reading today about a new book that's coming out, Golden Passport, about Harvard Business School and the effect that it's had on corporate America. I don't know whether you've noticed that at all, but it's sort of, I'm looking forward to reading it, but it sort of indicates from what I could read of the sort of brief review is that there is a kind of reason why we have these kind of sociopaths in corporate America and on Wall Street who seem to be devoid of humanity and completely money-driven. And I think the President of the United States fits that psychological profile as well. And he went to Wharton, which is another one of these hard-charging business schools like Harvard Business School. So do you think that there is some kind of conditioning going on there with all of these kind of military metaphors that they teach in business school, like take no prisoners, slash and burn, etc.?
Well, I do believe, this is a personal belief, that if the point of your work is simply to make money, then you are you're less likely to be interested in the product and how consumers feel about the product. In other words, my kids are interested in medicine, and I'd like to think they're interested in that because they would like the satisfaction of trying to make people well. Similarly, I would like to think that people that go into the high tech are trying to make cool applications or are fascinated by computers. But some people, and especially with Wall Street, I think the point of Wall Street for people going there is to make money. And once it becomes clear that making money is the goal as opposed to customer satisfaction, then it's a very near step to begin to step across the boundaries of what is appropriate and sometimes even what is lawful. So it both attracts or it self-selects for people that are maybe less socially conscious.
Well, just in closing, Bartonella, it seems unlikely that the Trump administration is interested in anything that we're talking about or anything that's happening with Wells Fargo. I mean, you've got, it's almost the entire, I think half the cabinet are Goldman Sachs alumni, aren't they?
Well, the pinwheel that is the Trump administration comes around occasionally to Public Citizen's point of view. They said some welcoming things about Glass-Steagall, but then it turns again and they talk about getting rid of all the Wall Street reform stuff. If you understand the Trump administration or can predict it, then I certainly would like to talk to you because I continue to be baffled and at the very least profoundly and sadly concerned.
Yeah, but Gary Cohn, whose stock apparently is rising at Steve Bannon's expense, and Steve Bannon, of course, was a minor player at Goldman Sachs where Gary Cohn was a big deal. He used to support Democrats, liberal Democrats and liberal causes until
sure.
Dodd-Frank, and then he became a Republican because that's his jihad is against Dodd-Frank from what it looks like. So,
I think he oversaw trading, and the Volcker Rule, Section 619 of the Dodd-Frank Act, takes a big shot at some of the trading operations that he oversaw at Goldman Sachs.
Right, but I think that indicates that Dodd-Frank could be in trouble, right?
Yes, I think Dodd-Frank is in trouble. In fact, what makes America safe, clean, stable is in trouble with what we're seeing from the Trump administration so far.
Right, and that may soon apply to the rest of the world. So I thank you very much, Bartlett Naylor.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who's the Financial Policy Advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the Principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as Chief of Investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. We're going to take a restation break. We're back and go to Wichita, Kansas, to get an update on the special election in the solidly Republican district.